I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I looked round the room and my brother and I had been pretending to be half of these guys in the back garden a few years earlier, you know, the elder statesmen, the Edriches, Illingworth, Cowdrey, D'Oliveira.
You're listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast with me, Will Rowe. These are the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. My guest on this episode of the podcast is one of the finest bowlers to ever play for England. He sits fourth in the all-time list of England's test wicket takers, behind Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad and his old teammate Ian Botham, with a phenomenal haul of 325 wickets in 90 tests, three appearances on the Lord's Honours Board, a ground where he performed brilliantly and where we're sat today to record this podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Bob Willis. How are you?
It's great to be here and great to be at Lord's again, as it always is. Even when the ground's empty, there's a special feeling coming here.
Wonderful. Yeah, we're sitting up in the, I think we're actually in the sky box today, keeping you on brand, Bob.
That's right.
looking out over the ground. It is beautiful to be here. First question, we're going to talk about your career today, a few of those moments at Lord's. It's an amazing career with some real ups and downs. What about the action? Where did that come from?
Well, I always thought it was a perfect bowling action till I was horrified to see myself on video. But I guess not so much the action, but the desire to become a fast bowler was born at school. I've never been a fan of rugby. And because I was tall, I was always put in the scrum at school. And there were other six-footers there who were twice as broad as me. So I got bullied around all winter on the rugby field. So the only way I could get my own back on these thugs was to try and knock their heads off in the summer playing cricket. So, well, that's my excuse for being a fast bowler anyway.
Although synonymous with Warwickshire and originally Surrey, Bob Willis is actually a northerner by birth. Born in Sunderland in 1949, he spends the first 6 years of his life in Manchester before his father relocates to London for work.
Well, when he was alive, my father was a journalist. He was working for the Sunderland Echo when I was born in 1949. But 6 weeks later, he got a job on the Manchester Evening Paper, and we moved to Chalton-cum-Hardy, which is only really a driver from Old Trafford Cricket Ground. So my first experience of watching cricket was at Old Trafford, watching Lancashire, and my love of Manchester City Football Club grew from my 6 years in Manchester. I remember going to sit on the white wall behind Bert Troutman's goal in 1955-56. Don't think we'd be allowed to do that these days. But
I believe as a four-year-old you went to the 1953 Ashes Test match at Old Trafford with an uncle and your elder brother David.
Correct, that's right. Yes, Uncle Joe Wardle took us along there. Yes, it always had a soft spot in my heart, Old Trafford. My My first recollections were of watching a Brian Statham bowl, and he became my hero. You know, fiery Fred Truman used to get all the headlines and all the publicity, but if one scrutinises Brian Statham's record, it's quite remarkable. And also, he didn't get himself in hot water as often as Fred, so... Brian should have probably played even more test matches than he did, but he was a great servant, uncomplaining, bowling into the wind, but had all the attributes for a top-class performer.
And when you got to the ground on that day, I think you... Did you sit behind the sight screen or something at that test match?
Yeah, we wondered. We wondered why we had all these seats to ourselves. And then, yeah, they moved the sight screen into position and we were... We were sitting behind it, so we had to mix with the hoi polloi and go and find another seat.
It's a lovely story. Once you went down to Surrey, what was your sort of your early years in childhood like? I sort of read in your book that your father was quite a strict man.
Yes, a fairly strict, old-fashioned upbringing, but he was always very keen to... encourage us to play sport. Both my brother and I were much better at soccer than rugby, and cricket was a passion close to my father. So I don't think he played that much himself, but he encouraged us to play. He was more keen on us going to the local recreation ground where my club cricket career started, rather than playing in the back garden and smashing windows in the greenhouse and the dining room. But we had an immaculate pitch in the back garden, and we marched out from the greenhouse, which was the pavilion. The problem was, my brother being older than me, he was always England, I had to be Australia, and you had to... They seemed to have a whole batch of left-handers, and of course you had to bat left-handed. So it's probably the reason why my batting career didn't quite develop as well as my bowling career. But no, they were happy times at junior school. I wasn't that happy at secondary school. It was a very good school, an old-fashioned grammar school in those days, RGS. It became an independent school shortly after I finished. But it was a very strict disciplinary school, and, you know, we had to join the combined cadet force and dress up in army uniform every Friday. So those sort of things are now happily long gone.
Bob attends the Royal Grammar School, but doesn't make the most of it. Flunking his O-levels, Bob's misery is compounded by having to resit his fifth year, something he's not keen on. But his cricket prowess is soon realised. In 1969, whilst living with school friend and now the Sky Sports football commentator Martin Tyler, the duo are based in Streatham in southeast London. It's here that Bob gets a trial at Surrey. He recalls his early days as a professional.
Early on, it was a pretty dramatic change playing cricket for fun,
yeah,
and then playing it for your living. And the sort of hierarchy of Surrey cricket in those days, and I suspect most county clubs were the same. You know, you were seen and not heard, and reported to the nets at 10 o'clock in the morning. Bowled at the first team till the nets came down at the Oval about 20 past 11, 11:30 start in those days. And then you sat on the balcony of the second team dressing room upstairs, willing the guys on the field to fail so you'd get an opportunity to show your skills in the first team. And it was a case of if you were summoned by the coach, the autocratic Arthur McIntyre, to go down to the first team dressing room, one had to knock on the door and put one's blazer on and all this sort of stuff. It was quite a tough upbringing.
It's interesting you talk about the kind of hierarchical nature of... Sorry, I chatted to Graham Foxy Fowler and he describes Lancashire in almost identical terms. It's all knocking on the door and he hated it. Your Surrey career began, but after 6 weeks, you almost quit. You were so disillusioned. Was that just... Were you just finding your feet or was it just a young man who was just a bit...
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't particularly enjoyable. You had to go off and score for the club and ground team. And, second 11 matches, they were spread all over the country. But there was, very much a senior-junior system. And there was always a scramble for the senior players, even in the second team, to take their motor car on away trips. So they'd get their petrol money and drive at 40 miles an hour to save petrol and all that sort of thing. And even though I was already 6'6" by this time, you had to travel in the back seat of the car. I remember... two occasions. One, I was in Stuart Story's Renault 5 in the back seat after bowling all day down at Swansea, five-hour drive back to London in those days, and I got cramp, and Pat Pocock, who was in the front seat, had to drag me out of the car sideways to relieve this cramp. And another occasion, we were going from the Oval to Scarborough and Yunus Ahmed took his girlfriend up to Scarborough for this match. And I travelled up with him and his girlfriend in a Hillman Imp. And I was in the back seat of the Hillman Imp for about 5.5 hours from London to Scarborough. So that's the way things were in those days.
And then you had this call-up to England at the age of just 21... Railingworth, I guess it was Ray. Did he make the call or where did it come from? But it was to go out to Australia to join the Ashes party.
Yes, Alan Ward, the Derbyshire quickie, got injured, a very serious shin injury, and he had to come home. And I was coaching with Chris Waller, who was a good friend and a second 11 colleague at Surrey, went on to have a more successful career at Sussex. He used to drive me to the Oval from Stoke Dabernon in Surrey every morning. And we were coaching at the Crystal Palace Recreation Centre, and the director came and said, "Oh, Bob, there's a phone call for you." And you always think the worst when you say there's a phone call at work. Anyway, I went to his office, and it was Billy Griffith, who was then secretary of MCC, saying that the MCC management wanted to go out and join the touring party in Australia. But I don't think Ray Illingworth had seen me bowl in the flesh, and it was certainly John Edrich who persuaded Illy to take me out as replacement for Alan Ward. They wanted to fight fire with fire, and they were keen to have a pace bowl. I mean, the likes of both Arnold and Jackman at Surrey were far more accomplished bowlers than I were, but pace was the order of the day in Australia. And so off I went. My dad quickly bought me a suit in Simpsons of Piccadilly, and I got a cricket case sign written by the guy who did all the sign writing at the Oval. And off I went on a 5-stop journey on a Boeing 707 to Brisbane.
Five stops?
Calling at, I can't remember them all. Certainly Amsterdam, Moscow, Beirut and Darwin. I can't remember what the fifth stop was, but... that was pretty shattering, but it was all like a fairy tale because I got to Brisbane and I met the guys after the day's play of the state match against Queensland. And I look around the room, and my brother and I had been pretending to be half of these guys in the back garden a few years earlier. You know, the elder statesmen, the Edriches, Illingworth, Cowdrey, D'Oliveira. So it was surreal from that point of view. And, you know, I thought I was just going to be a drinks waiter and play in the upcountry matches and the second round of state matches. And that looked like being the case until Ken Shuttleworth, the Lancashire paceman, got injured. And I was thrown in at the deep end during the fourth test at Sydney.
How did you sleep the night before that test? Did you?
Well, I think nerves are a good thing about playing international sport. But yeah, I was extremely nervous until I actually walked on to the ground to bat. But it was a huge thrill. I managed to put on some runs for the last wicket, I think. And we managed to win the test match thanks to John Snow bowling Australia out. So John became a little bit of a mentor and guru to me, in so much that he saved his best for test matches, and perhaps Sir Warwickshire's members thought that I saved my best for test matches as well during my career. But no, it was a big thrill to play in that and then to play the rest of the series. There were in fact 7 test matches. One was washed out. So I played in 4 of the completed 6 matches, and we won both the test matches at Sydney and won the Ashes back after 12 years. So it was really boys' own annual stuff.
Absolutely. What a way to start your test career. That test match at Sydney, you went wicketless in the first innings, but I think it's the second innings. Ian Redpath caught John Edridge, bowled Bob Willis. So that's where it all begins, the first of your many test wickets.
Well, in fact, I think you'll find that my first test wicket was Ashley Mallett, hooking off me. So we better do that bit again.
Are you sure it's not? I definitely checked that, and I'm pretty sure you got Redpath.
Wow. We'll have to have a look, but no, I'm pretty I thought I only got 1 wicket in the match, and it was Ashley Mallett.
I thought you got 1 wicket in the match and it was Redpath.
So, well, we'll check it up anyway. If we find out that it was Ashley Mallett, Ashley Mallett went for a hook shot and gloved the ball through to Alan Knott. I didn't make much of a contribution with the ball. I didn't have to with John Snow rolling them over.
Well, Bob's right. Ashley Mallett is his first test wicket. I stand corrected. It's a series not without controversy and a baptism of fire for a young Bob who learns exactly what Ashes cricket's all about. The most infamous incident comes at the SCG when John Snow's manhandled by spectators on the boundary after hit Terry Jenner with a bouncer. But England win back the Ashes after 12 years, 2-0. Bob returns to England but soon has a decision to make. He's struggling to get into the Surrey first team, competing with fellow paceman Robin Jackman.
Both Robin Jackman and I were playing in a Surrey second 11 game up in North London somewhere, Hornsey from memory. And I had a chat with Robin and said, well, look, one of us has got to move on here because, you know, we're not going to, our careers aren't going to progress being in and out of the first team and playing a lot of cricket in Surrey second 11. So, because I was younger than Robin and he was further on the road to the sort of promised land of a cricketer's benefit, I decided to leave Surrey in 71 and move up to Warwickshire. I think 12 of the 17 counties, as they were in those days, were interested in my services. But probably the fact that Bernard Thomas, the Warwickshire physio, was the England physio at the time, And I went up and was very impressed with the setup at Edgbaston. I decided to go there. Surrey weren't happy about me leaving.
Was it a bit bitter?
Well, it was, yes. I mean, they objected to my registration. I mean, it would never happen in these days, but I remember Bob Cotton was leaving Northamptonshire for Hampshire and I was leaving Surrey for Warwickshire, the winter of 1971. We both had to spend a period of qualification in the second 11 at our new counties. I think he till about mid-June, and I wasn't allowed to play for Warwickshire till the 1st of July. So that wasn't a brilliant start to my Warwickshire career, because I'd gone from the Surrey second 11 to the Warwickshire second 11.
Were you thinking, what have I done?
Yeah. And then, although I, you know, Alec Bedser, who was one of the principal selectors throughout most of my career, he hadn't forgotten about me, and I played, I think, in the MCC versus Australians match in 72. And then the following summer, I got back into the England side in the last Test match at Lord's against a very strong West Indies side. I think I managed 4 wickets in their only innings, but Canai, Sobers and Julian all got centuries.
That's it. Sobers, boarded by the England side, is a modest invasion of the turf. Fine 100 then for Gary Sobers. His 26th Test match 100.
Did they get 652 for 8 or something?
They did, yeah. It was about that. West Indies won by an innings and 226 runs. You did take 4 wickets. It was Sir Garfield Sobers' final Test match 100. So I guess sitting here now in 2018, at least you had the honour of being on the pitch to witness that. Maybe not at the time, you didn't feel the same way, but...
Well, yeah, it was ironic because I was good mates with Gary. I remember when we toured the West Indies the following winter that he actually met us at Barbados Airport and welcomed us to the West Indies. And his last Test innings at Kensington Oval, I got him out for a duck, but unfortunately, by that time, Lawrence Rhodes scored 300 and there was nearly another 700 on the board for the West Indies. That was the demise of Raymond Illingworth as England captain and player. Mike Dennis was named captain for the tour of the West Indies, much to the chagrin of Boycott and Greg, who had their eyes on the job. But it wasn't pleasant chasing leather against the likes of Canai, Sobers and Julian.
Well, a beautiful straight drive, beats Fletcher, goes through for 4, brings up the 400. What a wonderful shot from Gary Sobers. Packed house here now, really getting full value for money.
Bob Willis, who has 4 wickets. And another 4 runs, a very elegant, gentle stroke, really, from Sobers.
It was great. It was great watching Sobers bat. I'd first come across Gary playing for Nottinghamshire for Surrey in 1969, and that was my first... I think it was one of my early county championship matches. And I think they were about 16 for 4, and I'd taken all 4 wickets when Gary came in and smashed me straight back over my head in the first over and went on to make a big score. So, yeah, Sobers has got a lasting mark on my career.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
During the Ashes Down Under in 1975, Bob suffers a knee injury which forces him to return home. He struggles at Warwickshire that season, has operations on both knees, the scars you can still see to this day. So Bob has to change something, his training regime, and also, at a later date, he turns to hypnotherapy.
Tony Greig had taken over the captaincy of England in 1975, and we went to India under Greig in 76-7. Which culminated on a 10-day stop in Sri Lanka and then on to Perth and eventually Melbourne for the centenary test, which was an extraordinary cricket match, with the result being exactly the same as it had been in 1877. The Aussies winning, I think, by 45 runs. But Tony had looked after me throughout that tour. You know, I didn't play in the matches in India between the tests and, you know, kept me in cotton wool. And we won, amazingly, 3-1 in India. But both first innings in the centenary test were very low scoring. I think we didn't make 100 and they only made about 110 or something. And then there were huge second innings when the pitch flattened out and I basically ran out of steam. And after the match I was having a break in Sydney and we're having a barbecue at a hypnotherapist's house. I hadn't had hypnotherapy by then, but we're having a barbecue at this guy's house and Greig got really stuck into me. He said, you know, you let me down in Melbourne. I'd looked after you a whole tour. You ran out of puff. You know, you've got to get yourself much fitter and stronger if you want to, you know, play regularly for England and get to the top of the tree. And he said something very poignantly. There are going to be huge rewards for cricketers in the near future. That went flying over my head. I didn't know what he was talking about, of course, but it was precursor to World Series cricket was being planned at that very time after the centenary test. So it was then that I started hypnotherapy with Dr. Arthur Jackson in Sydney, and he gave me this program of long, slow distance running. So I came back and started this training regime, which was to run 5 miles in 35 minutes. Doesn't sound very fast. It's only 7 minutes a mile. But doing that on a daily basis certainly built up your stamina. And that was my modus operandi. I never was one for pumping iron in the gym or bowling lengthy periods in the nets. That was my religion, if you like. It was long, slow distance running to get fit for fast bowling. And obviously Arthur was in Sydney, so he sent me cassette tapes of Hypnosis to prepare for matches and relax and visualise success on the cricket field. And because I've always been an insomniac, relaxing tapes to help me sleep. And that transformed my career. I mean, if you look at my appearances for England between 70-71 and the centenary test match, they were pretty intermittent, in the side, out of the side, injuries here, injuries there. And then after 77, I had a long period injury-free. And apart from Imran Khan ricking my neck and unfortunately missing the 79 World Cup final with a shoulder injury, I hardly missed any matches for England. And so I've got a lot to thank Dr. Arthur Jackson for, and hypnotherapy. I mean, nowadays it would be taken as read that it would be an important part of modern care of a player, but of course then it was sort of hocus pocus witchcraft.
Very much ahead of his time in terms of the mental side of the game and staying physically fit by not over bowling himself, Bob enjoys consistent success for the remainder of his England career. But there was one time when his focus did let him down, when he went out to face Imran Khan without a bat.
Bob Taylor and I were batting at Edgbaston against Pakistan in 1982, and we'd put on a very important last wicket partnership, and tea had been delayed because of this partnership by half an hour. And we went in for tea, still 9 wickets down. And apart from my trusty Duncan Fernley Run Reaper cricket bat, I never had any batting kit of my own. I borrowed everything. Thigh pad, box, pads, helmet. And I came off and my batting gloves were, I think they were Chris Tavares' batting gloves, actually, were a bit sweaty. And I asked Ian Botham if I could borrow his batting gloves. And he said, yes, but make sure you wear the inner gloves, because I don't want you getting the palms of my batting gloves all sweaty. So I said, oh, yeah, that's fine, mate. So anyway, after the tea interval, waiting to go out and face more Imran Khan bouncers, I put the inner gloves on and tucked the batting gloves under my arm and marched out to the middle with no cricket bat. I think it was one of the most amusing moments in the BBC television commentary box of all time, when the captain was out in the middle without the willow.
Let's talk about 1977 at Lord's. It was against Australia. Mike Brearley was captain. World Series cricket had been announced. Tony Greg had been sacked by captain as the captain of England. It's quite a turbulent time for the game. But just talking about then about your training regime, this spell of bowling that you produced to take 7 for 78 was a wonderful spell of bowling to bowl them out when they were doing very well. Up until that point, I think they were 2 for 38 for 3. And then it was that kind of classic Willis spell of bowling where you got in the zone.
Yes, the zone, or my cocoon as it's called, I suppose, most famously in 1981, but certainly in 77 as well. Yes, it was a period of turmoil in the game. You know, the World Series cricket story had broken at the start of the Australian tour, and the Australian side was split between players who had signed up for Kerry Packer and those that hadn't. So they weren't a very happy bunch at all and didn't play to their potential during that series. And Brearley had taken over as captain. Our Packer representatives in the side were still selected for England then. And later in the summer, Bob Woolmer and Derek Randall and myself, and presumably Ian Botham as well, were invited to join World Series cricket. So yeah, it was certainly a difficult time in cricket, and it got worse after the first season of World Series cricket, when after the court judgment, players were allowed to play county cricket, but not for England, which caused a lot of friction in dressing rooms around the country. But going back to the Lord's Test match, I suppose in a way, a little bit like Stuart Broad in more modern times, getting in the zone or having a spell of bowling where you're inspired, where all the catches are taken, the batsmen don't play and miss, they edge the ball, and wickets tumble. It isn't luck, it is the sign of a top-class performer. Unfortunately, he couldn't turn it on at will, and it very rarely seemed to happen against the West Indies in those days.
But it did happen here, and it happened in that match against the Aussies, and regardless of the turmoil, beating the Aussies, winning here at the home of cricket, wonderful. And also it came from the nursery end, your unpreferred end, so to speak, but you got in that zone.
It's out, and it's a loose stroke from Greg Chappell, one of the few he's played, and Chris Auld is the man taking the catch.
And he's gone. Well, one of the worst balls that Bob Willis has bowled here all day long. Very wide, very short. Sargent going for the square cut, just getting a faint deflection through to wicketkeeper Alan Knott. So Sargent goes for 81. The fourth wicket is down for 238. And my word, he's caught it. It seemed initially that flicked off the pad. It was off the bat. Walters goes. Willis picks up another wicket.
Well, that's got to be close. Yes, indeed. I'd have thought that was absolutely plumb. Good delivery from Bob Willis. The fourth wicket with his second new ball. Marsh is out.
That's an edge, and it's taken this time. So Matt Walker goes, snapped up by Alan Knott off the bowling of Bob Willis. That's short. It's a catch. And in the very safe hands there of Alan Elam.
And there's no more need to conjecture about that, because Bob Willis has turned in his best ever bowling performance in a test match. He now has taken 7 for 78.
Greg Chappell, Chris Sargent, Doug Walters, they'd all scored 50s. You got rid of those three, and then you just ripped through Rob Marsh, Max Walker, Kerry O'Keefe, and then Jeff Thompson, Tomo. Clean bowled him. 7 for. Thank you very much.
You know, they had a mixture, as I say, of World Series cricket players. They had a pretty fine batting lineup, probably a better batting lineup than bowling lineup on that tour. But the recent epidemic of drop catches in Test matches, apart from early in the 81 series, we had very good close to the wicket catches throughout my career in my memory, when Brearley was captain or Greg was captain, they were in the slips taking good catches, and Botham came along, he was probably one of the best slip fielders of all time, and even the quicker bowlers, the likes of Mike Hendrick and Chris Auld, even Graham Dilley when his career started, were all capable fielders close to the wicket. And later on, Mike Gatting at short leg and close to the wicket, very brave short leg fielder, took some brilliant catches as well. So we all have catches dropped off us, but not quite as many as I think Anderson and Broad suffer these days.
There was Max Walker that was caught by Knott. That was a great ball. You used the slope perfectly there. It just held its line, just went away a bit down the slope, edge, and then Alan not behind the stumps, he's not going to drop any.
No, I was so fortunate through most of my career to have Alan Knott behind the stumps, and then Bob Taylor when Notty went off to World Series cricket. Those were two fantastic keepers, and Alan Knott, probably the best wicketkeeper of all time, anywhere, I think. And I remember on that 70-71 tour of Australia, Notty missed a chance off Illy's bowling, and Illy, in typical Yorkshire style, said, "Well, at least we know you're human now," because that was the only mistake I can remember him making. And of course, when Underwood was bowling, their relationship, which had been bred from down at Kent, it was almost mesmeric what they could do as a partnership. So yeah, it was no surprise when Notty took brilliant catches. And people forget that he also averaged over 30 with the bat and scored some very important runs for England. So he was a fantastic colleague to have in the team.
And that Test match, it goes on to be a draw. At one point, you looked like you could win it. But on a personal note, the honours boards didn't exist then, obviously, the physical ones. But to take a 5-wicket haul at Lord's, the home of cricket against Australia, it must have been a very proud moment for you.
Yes, I mean, success in any Ashes match is, cricket's this unique game, isn't it? It's a game played by individuals in a team environment. And although one's lying if you say you don't bother about personal statistics, of course you do, but hopefully the team ethic was always more important than personal achievements. But yeah, I mean, to walk off the field at the home of cricket with the crowd standing to you is a moment that one always remembers. And Lord's is unique in cricket that you very much walk through the crowd and the members in the long room on the way back to the revered dressing room. So yeah, a very, very special moment indeed.
In 1982, a year after his famous heroics at Headingley, Bob finds himself captain of England. Mike Brearley's retired, and it's only a year since Ian Botham was sacked. His first test is at Lord's against India, which he wins whilst taking 6 for 101 in the second innings. So was Bob expecting the job?
I certainly wasn't, no. I'd had a eye-watering offer to captain the South African Breweries side in early 82. It was £60,000 to captain the side for a month's work in South Africa. You imagine what £60,000 in 1982 was for a month's work. But I knew that the players who went would be banned from playing for England. And my whole raison d'etre in cricketing life was to play for England. You know, pulling on the England sweater, looking down at the crown and three lions was what I was on this earth to do, as far as I was concerned. So with Warwickshire's help, they gave me an extended contract and said they would pay me even if I was out of the game injured. I managed to resist the Krugerrands to go to South Africa. And of course, as 15 players went to South Africa, and Peter May didn't want Keith Fletcher to continue as captain. Both of them had gone as captain, given the job too early, and successive series against the West Indies doesn't help anybody in their captaincy career. By process of elimination, the arrow spun round to me. But yeah, it was still a great surprise, but an incredible honour to do that job, albeit with basically half a cricket team for the 2 years I was in charge.
Yeah, that team that the England side was here at Lord's: Jeff Cook, Tavare, Boycott, Lamb, Gower, Botham, Randall, Pringle, Edmonds, Taylor, Allett and Willis. That was the side that you walked out with against India. Did you find as a captain it's hard to know when not to bowl yourself or when to bowl yourself? Especially, you know, fast bowlers don't traditionally make captains.
No, there weren't many exceptions. I suppose Imran Khan would have been the most successful captain fast bowler. I don't think England had had one since Gubby Allen back in the 30s. No, it's not an easy job as a fast bowler. But I don't think I would ever have been accused of bowling myself too much or too little when I was captain. The most thing was when one was weary in the last session, was thinking about all the other bowlers and field placings, and quite often I'd get back to the end of my ridiculous 41 pace run up and turn around and find that Ian had moved a fielder here and there. But I was too weary to admonish him or change the field. So, it wasn't an easy job. I won all three series at home when I was captain. India and Pakistan in 82 and New Zealand in 83. But didn't manage to win away from home, unfortunately. No, I was not taking to captaincy like a duck to water, but tried to be innovative as a captain. I gave Derek Pringle and Neil Foster an early opportunity as two promising young cricketers.
Being in the zone, or your kind of the Bob Willis cocoon, I mean, you talked about it there, 41 pace run up and Ian's moving the field, like... How did you deal with that as a captain? Because as a player, you did get in these trance-like phases when you're bowling, but you clearly can't do that as a captain. You have to be concentrating on the game.
Yeah, it was quite difficult. Ian's got a tremendous cricket brain, and was probably, as I was, a better lieutenant, if you like, or vice captain type of figure than a captain, and he was a great help to me in terms of tactics, and as he always did, bowled his heart out for any captain he was playing under. But I didn't quite have the man management skills of a Brearley to get the best out of him away from home. I think he was finding touring difficult after he became this sort of superstar figure after the 81 Ashes, and he was more sort of rock star than sportsman, and found it difficult to go anywhere in public without being pestered.
And just to come on to your retirement, 1984, you were taken apart by Michael Holding, the West Indies bowler. That, in the end, brought to the end a fantastic England career. You retired 325 Test wickets at the time, top of the tree. Ian went past you, as did James Anderson and Stuart Broad in more recent years. In 1984, was it an easy decision to say enough's enough at that time?
Well, it was really my health which made the decision for me. I was captain in Pakistan in early 84, and I contracted hepatitis there and had to come home early from the tour. And after various tests at hospitals for tropical diseases, it was found that these symptoms kept recurring when I got exhausted bowling, and they kept recurring. And I remember test match at Headingley, although I bowled pretty well, as I think I was quoted as saying, Mikey Holding hit me places in Headingley that only the Yorkshire Ripper had visited before. So it was a fairly ignominious test match exit. And then my last ever match was at Lord's in the one-day cup final against Lancashire, where these symptoms again recurred, and again I lost the toss in a one-day final, and we got smashed by Lancashire, and that was the end of me, July 84. So it wasn't a particularly happy ending, but I decided after the illness in Pakistan that 84 was going to be my last season.
And how do you feel now, sort of sitting back, looking at your career? I guess immensely proud of what you achieved.
Very proud, particularly the second half of my career and having the privilege to play with the players that I did. I wish I'd got serious about fitness and mental preparation earlier in my career. There were certainly a few wasted years in the early 70s, so regrets about that, but none about representing England and winning the hearts of the England cricket supporters for long periods of time. And captaining England in whatever circumstances is a huge privilege, and it is like sporting royalty. And one has to learn to how to behave and how to conduct oneself as the England captain, because it is a very special position, and certainly led to great privileges after I retired. You know, one isn't invited into the BBC commentary box, as it was in those days, if one's just a run-of-the-mill county performer. But being an England captain almost gave you a passport into a career in broadcasting afterwards.
And is there any one moment that you could pick out that you really cherish now?
Well, clearly the Headingley 1981 test match was, boys comic stuff, really. Roy of the Rovers, call it what you will. But turning that match round, and then Ian turning that series round after a dismal start to 1981 when Kenny Barrington died on the West Indies tour. I'd come home injured from that tour. Ian's demise as England captain, and then really coming back and turning things round. 81, like for Ian, was probably the highlight of my career, and Ray Bright's middle stump going out at Headingley, probably the lasting memory.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to sit down and talk to you and not talk about Headingley 81, but for listeners, we have recorded a podcast on the Ashes, so you can listen to Bob discuss his memories of that. I just wanted to finish on, could you ever dream as a young schoolboy that one day that you would surpass Brian Statham's record? Well, 252 wickets he took. Did that disgruntled teenager down in Surrey think that would happen one day?
No, not really. I mean, I thought I was going to be probably an also-ran and a nearly man, concentrating more on Bob Dylan's music than my German geography and English homework, and, not making the most of my early professional career, but then having the huge boost of playing for England at an early age. But no, when I was running home from the local recreation ground in a bad temper after my brother had bowled me out first ball, I probably wasn't thinking I was going to play 90 test matches for England and captain them on 18 occasions.
Well, Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you very much for your time and coming on the Lord's Cricket Podcast.
It's always great to be at Lord's.
You've been listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast, the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. That was Bob Willis, one of England's greatest fast bowlers ever. Thanks again to Bob for taking the time to record that podcast. We did it in the JP Morgan Media Centre overlooking the ground where he was a fantastic bowler. It was really nice to sit down with Bob. He's a character that's sort of known for being a bit dry and almost playing the pantomime villain when he's on that Sky Cricket debate programme. But he does have, I think, a great sense of humour, and he's also quite introspective at times, especially towards the end there where we discussed his captaincy. I don't think he was a bad captain per se, but as he says, he was hampered by the Packer affair. He didn't have the strongest England side. And also, he wasn't expecting the job, and he was also a quick bowler. You know, that thing about 41-yard run-up, and then Ian Botham's changing the field behind his back. But yeah, a great character, and also way ahead of his times in terms of going on those long runs and, you know, the hypnotherapy stuff, which, as he said at the time, people thought was kind of hocus-pocus. But now, you know, every team, every cricket team, every sports team has guys that look after the mental aspect of the game for the players, which is so, so important. So, yeah. And also, I'd just like to say, if you were a bit bemused as to why we didn't discuss the Ashes in 1981, it's because we've already done a podcast with Bob Willis on that. So I've put the link to that in the liner notes of this podcast. So if you want to have a listen to that, it's there. It's myself, Phil Walker from Wisden, and Bob. And we sit down in the long room at Lord's and discuss the summer of 81. So there's a whole special on that summer. Well, that's it for this mini-series of the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the episodes with Bob Willis just now, Angus Fraser, Steve Kirby and Mike Brearley. All the episodes from the series and previous series are available to listen to, so please do go back and check them out wherever you consume your podcasts. I've now sat down with 12 cricketers and chatted through their careers and famous moments at Lord's. This podcast is from Lord's Cricket Ground. It's hosted on the Acast podcast platform. It's recorded, edited and produced by myself, Will Rowe. I'd like to give a special thanks to my colleagues Neil Robinson and Rob Kerfey in the MCC Library for all their help with the research. They're always great guys to go to. If I need to query a date or an incident that happened, Neil and Rob are always there to double check. And they also lend me plenty of books, which I squirrel away into. I'd also like to thank Nick Stroudley, Danish Roberts and Greg Stubley, who all work in MCC's digital content. They're the guys that make sure this all gets out to you on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, wherever they post it, and make sure that the podcast is as widely available as possible. If you do enjoy the podcast, please do leave a review or give it a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks as ever to the BBC and ECB for the commentary clips. And remember, you can reach out to the show via Twitter, @HomerCricket's the handle, or to me personally on @WillRowe2. Please keep it nice. There's also an email address, podcast@mcc.org.uk. So if you want to send anything in there, we'll have a read of it. So do get in touch. And once again, thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.